eyes to show up. All of a sudden, I heard the loudest sound, bang, I've ever heard. Hugely, immensely loud. Then all of a sudden I heard boom, 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 which I now think was the airplane tearing out the girders inside, followed by another boom. Everything exploded in flames. The ladies' room door actually burst out against its hinges, and out came a fireball. It singed the second wall. That's how far out it came.
Harry Weiser, Tax Counsel, Counter Fitzgerald, North Tower. I was in the elevator at 8:46 in the North Tower when the first jet hit the Trade Center. My office was on the 104th floor. I had gone up to the Sky Lobby on 78, and I'd made the transition over to the local elevators. I was somewhere between 78 and 104.
Jean Potter. I was thrown out of my chair, like thrown. It was this horrible loud explosion, and the building started rocking back and forth, and smoke filled the air immediately. We fortunately were right by a staircase because our floor was fully involved with fire. I heard of maybe 4 or 5 survivors from above us.
Vanessa Lawrence. I had literally put 1 foot out of the elevator on the 91st and was thrown to the side. Smoke and debris blasted down the corridor. The building shook.
David Cravett, bond broker, Cantor Fitzgerald, ground level lobby of the North Tower. All of a sudden, jet fuel blasted out of the central elevator bank and mushroomed everywhere. People were 20 yards from me, lifted on this fireball and thrown through those lobby windows and incinerated.
Kathy Pavlik. I ran around the floor, yelling, "A plane crashed into the building. We have to get out of here."
Vanessa Lawrence. I don't remember hearing anything. My memory is in silence and slow motion, but I know it was all happening very quickly and very loud.
Richard Eichen. I saw off my left shoulder an Asian man coming toward me. He looked like he had been deep fried. He had his arms out and his skin was hanging like seaweed. He was begging me to help him. He said, "Help me, help me," and then did a face plant right between my legs. He died between my legs. I looked down, and that's when I saw my shirt was full of blood. I didn't know before that I had been hurt. You could smell fuel. I had no idea what happened. I could see in the elevator shaft, floor-to-ceiling flames. It looked like a shower curtain shimmering. It's funny the things that you do in this situation. I put my bagel down in the entranceway and said, "I have to remember when it's over. I have to pick up the bagel and throw it away."
Robert Leader. The first thing that came to my mind was to call my wife. I told her that the World Trade Center had been hit by a plane. She didn't believe me. Right after I spoke with her, I opened a door to see what was going on, and this black, billowing smoke came straight at us. I shut the door right away. The whole office reeked of jet fuel.
Vanessa Lawrence. When the blast hit, the first thing that came into my head was, did I leave my tote by an electrical socket? It was that horrible thing. Oh my God, how am I going to explain this? Even going down the stairs, it was still, was this me? What if this is my fault?
Anthony R. Whitaker, World Trade Center, WTC Commander, PAPD, North Tower Ground Level Lobby. I saw two people out of the corner of my left eye. They were on fire. They ran toward me. And then they ran right past me. They issued no sound. All their clothes were burnt off. And they were smoldering.
David Cravett. One of the girls who worked with me, Lauren Manning, was coming into the lobby when that fireball came down and it took her through the glass. She was burned over 80% of her body and survived. If I was 20 yards further along on my walk, I would be dead or severely burned. There was no fire afterwards. It literally exploded out, burned itself out, and disappeared within seconds. It was 3, 4, 5 seconds at most.
Harry Weiser. The elevator started to fall. It burst into flames. I had a briefcase, a cloth briefcase, in my hand, and I was using it to try to beat out the flames. I was burned on my legs and on my arms.
The elevator initially was plummeting, then an emergency system kicked in because it started gliding. As it was going, I got hit in the face by a fireball that came in through the gap between the elevator doors and the body of the elevator. I have this impression of this orange ball coming at my face and a sensation, I can't call it a burning, of it making contact, and then it was gone.
David Cravette. It's a comedy of errors that I'm alive. Everyone else in my office upstairs that day perished. They were all trapped. There was no way out.
Meanwhile, hundreds of feet below the impact zone, people were still going about their day. The World Trade Center complex was so massive that those in the underground shopping concourses didn't feel the plane hit and did not realize something terrible had transpired until they saw others fleeing.
Alan Reese, director of the World Trade Center Port Authority. We went down to have coffee and a bagel at Fine and Shapiro, a deli restaurant right near where the A-train and E-train entrance was. I was sitting with my back to the concourse when my colleague, Vicky Cross Kelly, said, "Something must have happened. People are running like crazy on the concourse. They're panicked." I figured that there was probably someone with a gun or some holdup. I hadn't heard anything, didn't feel anything, smell anything.
Michael Amonico, executive chef, Windows on the World, inside the underground shopping complex underneath the towers. They took me into the examining room at LensCrafters and did the examination. The doctor examined my old glasses. The optometrist left me in the examining room, closed the door, came back in, burst through the door, really. He looked pale. He said, "Something happened. We've got to get out of here."
Across the 16 acres of the World Trade Center site, neighbors in the South Tower, 2 World Trade Center, watched the disaster unfolding in the North Tower. For some occupants of the towers, the 2001 attack was the second terrorist attack on the complex they had experienced. In 1993, a small group of Islamic extremists had exploded a car bomb in the parking garage beneath the North Tower, hoping it would topple the building. The explosion killed 6 and injured around 1,000 and provoked numerous security and fire safety improvements in the complex, some of which saved lives on 9/11. In the initial aftermath of the collision, many occupants reasoned that the incident would be similar to the 93 bombing. There wasn't necessarily mass panic or initial concern, even from some above the impact zone, who figured they could evacuate from the roof or just wait for firefighters to extinguish the fire below. Occupants in the South Tower were quickly reassured by an official building-wide announcement over the PA system that their building was not affected and were told to remain at their desks. Similarly, guests in the Marriott Hotel between the two towers realized something had happened, but continued to go about their day.
Robert Small, office manager, Morgan Stanley, South Tower, 72nd floor. The explosion on 9/11 felt very similar to the explosion in 93. I said to myself, geez, not again.
Elia Zedeno, financial analyst, Port Authority, North Tower, 73rd floor. The building shook. I thought, this is it. I am going down. And immediately I thought, earthquake. But instantaneously it was, earthquake? 1993. There was no pause thinking, what could it be? Nothing like that. It was earthquake. No. 1993. I immediately thought, in 1993, I didn't have my keys to get home. Today, I am going to have my keys.
Herbuita. When the building shook, I knew immediately from the 1993 bombing experience to leave. No one could have dissuaded me. I knew, though, my son Todd was on the 105th floor.
Harry Weiser. I was in shock. I got off the elevator. I was remarkably calm. I had my bag still with me. I walked over between 2 of the larger elevator banks, put it down, and said, I can't carry this right now, and I'll get it back later.
Michelle Cartier, Lehman Brothers, North Tower. I was working on the 40th floor for Lehman Brothers. Everybody started clearing the floor, and we began our descent. Nobody knew exactly what was going on. There was no indication that this was a terrorist attack. We pretty much thought you'd go back outside, you'd come out, you'd come back upstairs, and you would go about your business.
Jared Coates. One of my colleagues, Samara Zwanger, had the phone number for David Rivers, one of our editors, who was in the conference at Windows on the World. He told her that nobody knew what had happened. There had been a huge explosion, all the windows had fallen out, all the ceilings had come down, and everyone had been knocked to the ground. But everyone was okay, and everyone was going to be evacuated.
Constance Labetti, accountant, Aon Corporation, South Tower, 99th floor. Our boss, Ron Fazio, knew he had to get us out of there. He said, go to the staircase. I returned to my desk to grab my sneakers, because I had 99 flights to descend. I started to climb down on the steps. I still had my heels on and my sneakers in my hand. I remember hearing the PA announcement come on. The PA announcement said, do not evacuate. Stay where you are. We have no structural damage. There's structural damage to Tower 1, which we're evacuating. But Tower 2, go back to your workstations. I caught up to a couple in the staircase, maybe the 90th floor, 92nd floor. I said to them, could you wait a moment while I put my sneakers on? They said, of course we'll wait. I was trembling so much that I couldn't tie my sneakers. I remember the man saying to me, just tie your sneakers. Don't worry. Don't worry. I tied my sneakers. Then we continued on down.
Judith Wine. It was a wide staircase, and we were going down two abreast. There was a little space in the middle. Every once in a while, I saw somebody go up, come up. They would mumble, oh, I left such and such on my desk. I'm always wondering, in retrospect, did they ever come back down?
Robert Small. People on my floor started to leave. A friend of mine and I started to watch it on television in one of the boardrooms. We walked north, looking out the windows, and you could see the smoke, you could see the flame. We started trying to guess what was falling. Was it a book? Was it a piece of paper? Was it a drape? Was it a chair? After a few minutes, we saw people jumping, falling, landing. That wasn't good. After a few of those, we decided not to watch. Let's go back, call our families, let them know we're okay. Still thinking everything was in the North Tower. Nothing was going to happen at the South Tower.
Michael LaMonaco. I got out into the corridor. There was an official from the Port Authority motioning with the arms. He was telling people, run, get out. I exited out onto Liberty Street, crossed over to Church Street. I turned and looked back to see what had happened. I could see the horrific fire in Tower 1. I thought maybe there had been an explosion.
Frank Rosano, guest, Marriott Hotel. I remember hearing a big bang. I got up out of bed. I opened the drapes on the windows on the Liberty Street side of the building. I saw papers fluttering down to the ground. I said to myself, well, it must have been a big wind that must have blown off the harbor and blew a pane of glass out in one of the buildings. I turned around, closed the drapes, and got back in bed.
Michael LaMonaco. I thought, oh my God, everybody at work. I thought, what's happening on 106? Then the next thought was, okay, I'm going to stay calm. They'll go down the fire stairways. I had complete optimism that people were coming down.
News of the crash reverberated across the city as New Yorkers struggled to understand what had happened. The attack interrupted primary day across New York City as voters planned to choose a successor to Mayor Rudy Giuliani. The confusion was especially pronounced in Lower Manhattan, one of the most densely packed areas of the United States. As the crash was felt or witnessed by hundreds of thousands of people in nearby apartment buildings, offices, hospitals, transit terminals, schools, and across the financial district surrounding Wall Street, just blocks away. One of the schools closest to the World Trade Center, just three blocks south of the complex, was the High School for Leadership and Public Service, HSLPS. One of New York City's small specialty schools, home to about 600 students and 40 faculty.
Ada Dolch, principal, HSLPS. At about 8:45, the lights in the lobby went out. Within 10 seconds, the lights went right back on,
And immediately after that, there was this very loud bang, this very loud explosion.
Heather Ordover, English teacher, HSLPS. We all heard the scream of the engines like a bomb in a war movie. Then the flash. The kids ran to my back window. I ran to my back window. We saw burning paper, smoke, falling debris. I ran back to the front of the room, yelling to the kids to sit down and write about what they'd just seen. Anything to get them away from the windows. Keturah Bostic, student, HSLPS. One of the teachers, Mr. Donnelly, ran into our classroom saying, "Did you see that?" Everyone screamed, "What?" He responded, "The airplane went right into the tower and we saw everything." A few seconds later, Mr. Bronsnick came on the loudspeaker and said that the crash was being controlled by the firemen and didn't affect us, and that it would still be a full day of school.
Rezvan Hotarano, student, HSLPS. There were papers everywhere, like the Yankees parade, and a lot of ash.
Ada Dulch. Through the radio, we could hear that something was going on at the World Trade Center. I knew that that's where my sister Wendy worked for Cantor Fitzgerald. The words out of my mouth were very clear. "God, please take care of Wendy. I have to take care of the kids in the school."
Fernando Ferrer. The Twin Towers loomed large in the consciousness of the city. In 2001, it was even a part of the political and governmental dialogue of New York because at that time, they were on the brink of being sold. I had made a specific proposal that the proceeds of the sale of the Twin Towers would go toward a fund for affordable housing in New York City. We were on our way to Manhattan, coming down from the Northeast Bronx on the Bruckner Expressway to the Triborough Bridge Toll Plaza. My young assistant, Kalman Yeager, got a call from his wife, and I heard his end of the conversation. "There's a fire in the World Trade Center?" Kalman told all kinds of jokes, good sense of humor. I thought he was kidding. "Fire in the Trade Center? Oh, there goes my housing plan." Then he said, "No, this is for real."
Julian Volk, preschool teacher, Lower Manhattan. I was on the corner of Church and Thomas at work, about a 5-minute walk from the Trade Center. My fiancé, Kevin Williams, worked in Tower 2 for a small investment banking firm on the 104th floor. I felt something. My classroom shook. One of my students looked at me and said, "It's thundering." I knew it wasn't thundering. A woman came running into the hallway and said a bomb had gone off in the Trade Center. I panicked. I called Kevin, hoping I would get an answer. He picked up his line and told me a plane had gone into Tower 1 and he had to go because they were being evacuated. He wasn't panicked or anything.
Howard Lutnick, CEO, Cantor Fitzgerald, North Tower. It was my son Kyle's first day of kindergarten. As I walked him upstairs, an administrator grabbed me and said, "Your office is looking for you. The plane has hit the building." I jumped in the car, and as I got down there, I saw that huge black billowing smoke. The guy driving my car started crying.
Jimmy Mayo, driver for Howard Lutnick. We had a clear shot from the 40s on down on Fifth Avenue, right at the World Trade Center. I knew all our people were above where that smoke was coming out of and would have no shot of getting out.
Andrew Kurtzman, City Hall reporter, New York One. I was scheduled to host election night coverage on New York One that night, so I slept in that morning. The telephone rang and it was my mother. She was incredibly agitated. All she said was, "Can you believe it?" I was like, "What?" She said, "Turn on the television." It became apparent this was a catastrophe. I bolted out of bed and I had to decide, this sounds ridiculous, whether to take a shower. For months afterward, I felt guilty about running into the shower. I took the fastest shower I've ever taken, got dressed, grabbed a pen, a reporter's notebook, and my reporter's press pass, put it around my neck, and went bolting out of my apartment.
Rudy Giuliani, Mayor, New York City. I was having breakfast at the Peninsula Hotel right off 5th Avenue, 55th Street. We were beginning to stand up to leave the table. My staffer, Denny Young, came over and said, "A twin-engine plane had hit the North Tower of the World Trade Center." I went to the men's room because I thought I'd be at the crash site a long time.
Andrew Kurtzman. I hailed a cab, jumped into it, and screamed, "Take me to the World Trade Center."
Rudy Giuliani. we rushed down in my SUV. One of the things that has always remained in my memory is we were passing St. Vincent's Hospital in the village, and I saw many doctors and nurses and attendants in the street with stretchers. It was the first time a feeling registered with me. This looks like a war zone. It must be worse than I thought. They must know something that hasn't been conveyed to me about how bad this is.
Outside the towers, the sound and sight of the crash prompted an immediate call to arms by firefighters, police, paramedics, EMTs, and other first responders. For nearly 400 of them, it would be their last. At 8:58 a.m., en route to the scene, Chief Esposito issued an order for a Level 4 mobilization to the World Trade Center, the NYPD's highest level of alert, summoning nearly 1,000 officers to the disaster site. That same minute, an NYPD helicopter hovering over the towers reported that roof rescues, which had been successful following the 1993 bombing, would be impossible due to the volume of heat and smoke. Minutes later, Chief Esposito ordered that given the conditions, no helicopters should attempt to land on the roof. Although they don't know it, the fate of everyone above the 91st floor in the North Tower was already sealed.
Sal Cassano, Assistant Chief, FDMY. On the morning of September 11th, I was at headquarters in Brooklyn. Sitting with me was Chief of Department Peter Gansey, Chief of Operations Dan Nigro, Donald Burns, Jerry Barbara. Jerry was killed. Donald was killed. Peter was killed.
Dan Nigro, Chief of Operations, FDNY. I heard a loud sound. I thought someone had dropped something heavy in the office above me. The next thing I heard was Pete Gansey shouting, "Look out the window, a plane hit the World Trade Center." We decided to go together, Pete Gansey and I, in his car so we could talk strategy on the way there. We flew over the Brooklyn Bridge and arrived in about 5 minutes at the base of the North Tower.
Tracy Donahue, Transit Officer, NYPD. I had graduated from the police academy in May. It was my second day actually on patrol, in uniform, with a senior officer, in an actual job. My post was Broadway Nassau, one block away from the World Trade Center, standing on the northbound 4 and 5 platform. We heard over the radio, 10:13, an airplane hit the World Trade Center. We were like, what? We heard it again. 10:13, 10:13, a plane hit the World Trade Center. We ran up the stairs. A 10:13 means everyone run to the aid of whoever or whatever is going on.
William Jimeno. Our police desk said all officers had to come back to the police desk. I met up with Dominic Pizzullo. He was a great guy, and he goes, Willie, something must be really bad for them to call us all back to the police desk.
Captain J. Jonas, Ladder 6, FDNY. I could start to see from our firehouse in Chinatown the black plume of smoke going across the sky, I said. Everybody get their gear on. Let's get going. Engine 10 transmitted a second alarm and a 1060 signal, which is massive casualties.
Lieutenant Mickey Cross, Engine 16, FDNY. A computer went off, and we got the ticket, respond to Manhattan, box 8087, One World Trade Center, signal 33. That's a third alarm. It was engine 7, engine 55, engine 3, engine 16, that's my company, ladder 5, rescue 4. It said, respond to lobby command post, One World Trade Center. It's incident 103, 103rd incident in Manhattan of that date.
William Jimeno. Inspector Lawrence Fields, who was the commanding officer at the bus terminal for the Port Authority Police, came in and said, we've commandeered a bus on 9th Avenue. We need the following people to get on the bus.
Dan Nigro. As we approached Manhattan, we discussed what we were going to do when we got there. Chief Gansey transmitted a fifth alarm. It was already a third alarm assignment, which would be approximately 14 engines and maybe 7 ladder companies. The fifth alarm would give us a couple of additional chiefs, 8 additional engines, and 6 additional truck companies.
Francine Kelly, a registered nurse and nurse manager, St. Vincent's Catholic Medical Center in New York City. Other staff and physicians at St. Vincent's literally said they were walking into the emergency department looking down 7th Avenue when they saw the World Trade Center get hit. Within 2 minutes, we were already calling our disaster code.
Jeff Johnson, firefighter, engine 74, FDNY. We knew we were going to something pretty catastrophic. Captain J. Jonas. It looked fake, to be honest. The sky was so blue, and the sun was glistening off the metal of the exterior of the World Trade Center. You saw an airplane-shaped hole in the North Tower with fire and smoke coming out of the building under pressure. It was boiling out. I still can't believe how bad it looked.
Meanwhile, uptown, FDNY Fire Education Director Joseph Turillo was heading to his press conference in Midtown Manhattan for the 9 a.m. unveiling of the Billy Blazes Rescue Hero.
I was driving over the Brooklyn Bridge. I could see the North Tower, and I was like, whoa. I could see about 10 floors of fire all around the top of the building. Now, as a firefighter, as an engineer, that's an uncontrollable fire. Three college fire cadets were sitting in the back seat of my car to help at the press conference. Joe Broadbent, one of the fire cadets, said to me, "What do you think is going on?" I said to him, "Everybody on the top of the building is going to die." I said, "The building is going to collapse." As I got to the other side of the Brooklyn Bridge, I said to myself, "This press conference ain't happening today." I knew all the firefighters in Engine 10, Ladder 10, who I spent the bulk of my career with, were going to be the first ones in that building. And they're going to need as much help as they could get.
Dan Nigro. I said, "Pete, this will be the worst day of our lives."
In both the North and South Towers, office workers began to evacuate, while far below, first responders arrived, took stock of the scene, and formulated plans for rescues. Almost immediately, heroes began to emerge inside the buildings, while spouses, family members, and friends tried to figure out whether their loved ones at the World Trade Center had been affected.
Lila Spessener, paralegal, Port Authority, North Tower, 88th floor. Our colleague Frank DiMartini saved our lives. He was running all over the floor looking for people, gathering people. He came barging into the office and said, "You gotta leave, staircase, whatever it was, I don't even remember, A, B, or C. It's open and it's clear." Frank told all of us, "Move." We walked in a very orderly fashion. After we left the floor, there was still plenty of smoke and milling around and what have you, but everybody left. He stayed on the 78th floor lobby. He stayed because there was someone in the elevator, trapped, banging on the door.
Edna Ortiz, wife of Pablo Paul Ortiz, superintendent of construction. Port Authority, North Tower. Mr. DiMartini and Paul were going office to office trying to let them out, because doors had jammed. The people they rescued remember them using crowbars to try to get the doors open.
Joe Massian. We made our way into a stairwell. At this point, it reminded me of an elementary fire drill. Very calm, very collected, nobody pushing, nobody shoving.
Harry Weiser. I don't know whether to think of it as an incredible sense of calm or a sense of unreality, but I was entirely focused. I did not have a clue how badly I was hurt. I thought, I have to get downstairs, I have to get to the lobby, and I have to get to help.
Vanessa Lawrence. We had gone down the stairs. I remember the first few floors being filled with smoke and debris. The sprinklers were on. It was dark. Then I remember going downstairs further and lights were on and people were coming out of their offices. The sprinklers were strong. I had my flip-flops on and I took them off because I was slipping all over the place.
Richard Eichen. I said, "Okay, I better figure out how badly I'm hurt." I felt that my face was all bloody. The left side of my head was open and I could put my hand in there. I could feel my skull. I could actually feel the bone. It stung, but it didn't really hurt because I think I was in shock. Then I said, "Okay, I've got to do something here."
Harry Weiser. As I was walking down, I caught a glimpse of my arm and saw a blackened flap of skin hanging down. It was almost matter of fact, telling myself, "Okay, you don't want to look at that again. Just look at the feet, look at the steps, keep walking."
John Abruzzo, staff accountant, Port Authority, North Tower, 69th floor.
I'm a C5, C6 quadriplegic, so I'm able to function and get around on my wheelchair. I remember the building suddenly swayed, and that it swayed in one direction only. I looked out the north windows, and debris was raining down. I must have been in a state of shock. The thing that brought me out of it was my supervisor shouting some expletive. He was outside my cubicle saying we had to evacuate.
Peter Bitwinski, assistant manager, accounts payable, Port Authority, North Tower, 69th floor. I've known John for a long time. Our desks were side by side for many years in accounts payable, so needless to say, he was a close friend of mine. I said, John, where's your evacuation chair?
John Abruzzo, I had been there in 1993 when the World Trade Center was bombed. Different job, same floor. A group of Port Authority employees and two fellows from Cantor Fitzgerald, plus some other folks from Deloitte and Touche, were all there to help evacuate me. It took us 6 hours to get out. After the 1993 bombing, the World Trade Center purchased these evacuation chairs.
Peter Bitwinski. He seemed to be in shock. He didn't even respond to me, so again I said, John, do you know where your chair is?
John Abruzzo. They made it clear I was going with them, one way or the other.
Joe Massian. Back then, two-way pagers were big. Pagers were working. People were getting news through pagers of what happened, the plane crash. I didn't realize it wasn't a small plane.
Edna Ortiz. I received a phone call. It was Paul, and what he told me was that something had happened, but he didn't know what it was. And if I turned on the television, not to worry because he was okay. I said, all right. He said, I'll get back to you. I'll call you as soon as I can.
Joe Massian. We continued to file down. Occasionally you would hear, move left. And move left meant that you would all push to the left side of the stairwell and actually look at the wall because somebody was coming down who was burnt.
Edna Ortiz. I turned on the television and saw what had happened. I picked up the phone and called him back. When he answered the phone, he asked me what happened, and I explained to him that it was a plane. He said, okay, there are things I gotta do here, so I have to go right now. I'll talk to you as soon as I can. He hung up. I called him and asked what he was doing. He told me he was getting people out. I asked him, when he was done, to get out too.
Janelle Guzman, office assistant, Port Authority, North Tower. I worked in the Tunnels, Bridges, and Terminals division on the 64th floor. I thought that it probably was an earthquake because back home in my country, in Trinidad, I had experienced an earthquake with that shaking. I came back to my cubicle and other co-workers were leaving. They said, I don't know what's going on, but we think some plane hit the building. My supervisor came over and he said, Janelle, we've got to leave. Grab your bag. That's it. We're out of here. A plane hit the building.
Pasquale Bazzelli, engineer, Port Authority, North Tower. I remember I was up late watching Monday Night Football, so I was a little late getting into work. I didn't get in until probably close to 9 o'clock. I worked on the 64th floor. It was during the express elevator part of that trip that I felt what was the plane hitting the building, the impact. The elevator shook violently, the lights flickered. At my office, I went right over to my boss, Pat Hoey, at the time. I said, Pat, do you know what happened? He was like, I don't know. I'm trying to find out. The floor was well lit. Phones were functioning. Computers were on. Everything seemed pretty normal. So right away, I phoned my wife, Louise. She was at home, 7.5 months pregnant.
Louise Bazzelli, Riverdale, New Jersey, and wife of Pasquale Bazzelli, Port Authority, North Tower, 64th floor. It was tough sleeping through the night because I was at the end of the pregnancy and I'd be up half the night tossing and turning. The morning was probably my best time to actually sleep. It was about 8:30, 8:45, and the phone rang.
Pasquale Bazzelli. She goes, what's the matter? Is everything okay? I said, no, everything's fine. I'm here at work. I said, don't be alarmed. Turn the television on and tell me what you see. Something happened in the building.
Louise Bazzelli. I got up out of bed. Right away I turned on the television and I didn't have to search at all. Any station I went on, I saw the top of his building on fire. I said, oh my gosh, Pasquale, your building's on fire. Why are you calling me?
Pasquale Bazzelli. She said, they're saying that a plane hit the building.
Louise Bazzelli. He promised he was going to be leaving and he would call when he got downstairs. That's when we hung up.
Pasquale Bazzelli. Whatever was happening, the fire was above. There was nothing below, and not thinking of a collapse, I thought I was okay. Eventually, we were going to get out, so it wasn't an issue. We were not on fire here. There was no smoke here. There was never a decision of, hey, let's leave. Part of that was because we probably wanted to keep the stairwell clear so we could allow access, have the firemen reach the point of impact. Why clutter the stairs even more?
First responders flooded into the World Trade Center within minutes. Many summoned by escalating alarms, but others simply saw what had transpired and, knowing the city faced an unprecedented calamity, made their way to the site. As the morning unfolded, rescue efforts encompassed not just the Twin Towers, but the whole World Trade Center site, including the 22-story Marriott Hotel sandwiched between the two towers and the 48-story office building known as 7 World Trade Center that housed commercial tenants like Salomon Brothers, as well as numerous government offices for agencies like the Secret Service, the IRS, and New York City's Emergency Command Center, its Office of Emergency Management. The neighboring 39-story skyscraper, known as the Deutsche Bank Building, was also affected. Given the scale of the tragedy, numerous specialty and elite rescue units were being dispatched, including the NYPD's Emergency Service Unit and the FDNY's special rescue units.
Scott Strauss, officer, Emergency Service Unit, Truck 1, NYPD. The Emergency Service Unit, or the ESU, is the SWAT and rescue team for the city of New York. We handle every kind of crisis, any large-scale event from bomb jobs, hostage jobs, barricaded perpetrators, people jumping off of buildings, people jumping off of bridges. We cut people out of cars. We handle hazardous material incidents, weapons of mass destruction incidents. We're the answer to the city police's problems. If the precinct cops can't handle the situation, they'll give us a call.
Detective David Brink, Emergency Service Unit, Truck 3, NYPD. We started making our way down to the Trade Center. I saw the building burning. I looked over to my colleague, Mike Garcia, and I go, I guess we're going to get a lot of work in today.
Scott Strauss. Every police officer was working their way down to the Trade Center. Traffic was terrible. There were civilians directing traffic, trying to get the emergency vehicles through.
David Norman, Officer Emergency Service Unit, Truck 1, NYPD. There was a lot of debris falling from the building. Stuff was raining down on top of us when we initially pulled up. We gathered our equipment, donned our self-contained breathing apparatus, donned our rope rescue gear, our medical gear, and elevator equipment. Things like that.
Detective David Brink. The equipment that day probably went around 70 pounds. When we were walking toward the towers, our arms were hanging heavy from all the equipment that we had on us.
Detective Steven Stefanakos, Emergency Service Unit, Truck 10, NYPD. You could imagine the madness of the scene.
Detective Sergeant Joe Blozes, Crime Scene Investigator, NYPD. There were thousands of people running. The fright was etched in their faces.
Dr. Charles Hirsch, Chief Medical Examiner, City of New York. I will never forget seeing an airplane engine in the middle of West Street, and then an amputated hand next to it.
Alan Reese. A detective, Richie Paw, and I went out onto the plaza. We saw the gash in the tower and people jumping. It really wasn't safe to be out there. But we see a wheel of a plane, and this detective said, that's evidence. We have to take it back with us. I said, are you crazy? Richie said, no, that's it. And drags this thing back into the Port Authority police desk.
Tracy Donahue. People were all streaming out of the building. My mindset was, the fire department's going to get here. They're going to go upstairs, they're going to put out this fire, and that's the end of the day. As we know, it wasn't that at all. It escalated.
Anthony R. Whitaker. I ordered the cop at the desk to begin a full-scale evacuation of the entire complex.
Alan Reese. I spoke to the people up in Windows on the World who I knew, telling them, we're going to see if we can get the fire department up there. but take a napkin, wet it with the water from a flower vase, and cover your face to breathe through it. I didn't think we were going to make it up there. I had my real doubts.
Jay Swithers, paramedic, FDNY. A lot of patients were coming out of the plaza, and immediately the EMS crews on the scene were giving them triage tags we use to identify who should go first. They start out with green, which are people who are walking wounded who could basically stay. Then it goes to yellow, which are people that basically will need an ambulance, but they're not serious at the time. The next one is immediate. Immediate is a red code. A lot of patients were hysterical, crying. The Millennium Hotel became very helpful. They were bringing out nicely padded chairs from the lobby. They're beautiful chairs for patients to sit down.
Captain Jay Jonas. I was heading toward the ground floor lobby command post when I ran into Ladder 3 and Captain Patty Brown. Patty was almost a larger-than-life type of person, very highly respected by everyone in the fire department. He served two tours of duty in Vietnam as a Marine, got his discharge, and became one of the most highly decorated firemen in the history of the fire department. He's very well-liked, very well-known, very compassionate guy. He said, "Jay, don't even report into the command post. They're just going to send you upstairs." I almost said, "All right, I'll go upstairs with you." Instead, I said, "Let me check in first. I'll meet you upstairs." I reported into the command post. I was standing there waiting to get orders, and I saw Commissioner Von Essen talking to Pete Hayden, who was the deputy chief running the fire. I heard Hayden say to Von Essen, "We're not putting this fire out. This is strictly a rescue mission." Jeff Johnson, firefighter, engine 74, FDNY. As soon as we got into the Marriott Hotel, there were a number of companies and civilians in the lobby of the hotel. We asked the chief what we should do. He said, "Well, we have to check these reports of people in the Marriott." There were a considerable amount of firemen in the building at the time. They looked like bumblebees. We took the elevator up to the 18th floor. We went up the south stairwell to the highest floor we could find. It is considered a 22-story building. The gym was on 22. As we were searching the area, I happened to look into one particular area, and it was a spa, a jacuzzi, a big one. In the jacuzzi was part of the landing gear from the plane.
Anthony R. Whitaker. All that morning, I don't think I really had a good understanding of what was going on. Whatever it was bigger than us.
Al Kim, Vice President of Operations, Transcare Ambulance. We had no idea the scope of what was going on above us. The buildings are so large and the footprint so big, and you're at the base of it, you can't crane your neck back far enough to see what's really going on.
Thomas Von Essen, Commissioner, FDNY. Nothing could have ever really prepared us for what happened, or how fast the events would unfold.
United 175, do you read New York? The second hijacking. The second plane, United Airlines Flight 175, also en route to Los Angeles from Boston, was hijacked minutes before American Airlines Flight 11 crashed into the World Trade Center. United Airlines Flight 175 had 9 crew and 56 passengers aboard. Moments before the American plane hit Tower 1, the pilots of United 175 heard the distress call from American Airlines Flight 11 and reported it to air traffic control. 8:41 a.m. United Airlines Flight 175.
New York, United 175, heavy.
Air traffic control.
United 175, go ahead.
We figured we'd wait to go to your center. We heard a suspicious transmission on our departure out of Boston with someone...
Someone seized a mic
and said, "Everyone, stay in your seats."
Oh, okay. I'll pass it along over here.
So I cut out.
8:51 a.m. 10 minutes later, air traffic control tried to pass along routine instructions to the flight. It never responded again.
United 175, recycle your transponder. Score code of 1470. United 175, New York. United 175, do you read New York? Delta 1489, do you read New York?
Delta Flight 1489.
Delta 1489, go ahead.
Okay, just wanted to make sure you read New York. United, United 175, do you read New York?
9 a.m. In the final minutes of flight UA 175, passengers phoned family members and left voicemails of care and concern. Brian Sweeney, a 38-year-old former F-14 pilot in the Gulf War, left a voicemail for his wife, Julie Sweeney Roth, in Massachusetts. He told her, "I'm on an airplane that's been hijacked. If things don't go well, and it's not looking good, I just want you to know I absolutely love you. I want you to do good, have good times. Same with my parents. I'll see you when you get here." Peter Hansen, 32, traveling with his wife, Sue Kim, 35, and their 2.5-year-old daughter, Christine, called his father. Christine would be the youngest victim on September 11th. Peter said, "It's getting bad, Dad. A stewardess was stabbed. They seem to have knives and mace. They said they have a bomb. It's getting very bad on the plane. The plane is making jerky movements. I don't think the pilot is flying the plane. I think we are going down. I think they intend to go to Chicago or someplace and fly into a building." Then he tried to reassure his father. "Don't worry, Dad. If it happens, it'll be very fast." 9:01 a.m. Below, on the ground, confusion spiraled at air traffic control as various sectors tried to piece together the rapidly changing events, even to understand that a second flight had been hijacked, and muster a response. Peter Mulligan, FAA New York Center.
"Do you know if anyone down there has done any coordination to scramble fighter type airplanes?"
Controller at FAA Command Center, Herndon, Virginia.
"Do you still think the airplane's in the area?"
"No, we have several situations going on here. It's escalating big time. And we need to get the military involved with this."
"Wow, what's going on?"
"Just get me somebody who has the authority to get military in the air now."
9:02 a.m. Learning that a second plane had been taken over, New York Air Traffic Control called other FAA offices to try to spot United Flight 175 as it approached Manhattan.
"Hey, can you look out your window right now?"
New York Terminal Radar Approach Center, TRACON, Long Island.
"Yeah, can you see a guy about 4,000 feet, about 5 East Airport right now? Looks like he's..."
"Yeah, I see him."
"You see a guy, look, is he descending for the building also?"
"He's descending really quick too, yeah."
"Well, that's
2,500 feet now. He just dropped 800 feet in like one sweep."
That's another situation. What kind of airplane is that? Can you guys tell?"
"I don't know. I'll read it out in a minute. Another one just hit the building."
"Wow. Oh my God. Another one just hit it hard. Another one just hit the World Trade.
The whole building just came apart."
"Oh my God. Holy smokes. All right. I guess you guys can be busy." Okay.
A host of potential problems. The military gears up. Across the eastern United States, those in charge of the nation's airspace, both the military air defense units and civilian air traffic controllers, dealt with the confusion sparked by a second hijacking, even as they were unsure about the fate of American Airlines Flight 11.
Colin Scoggins, Airspace and Procedures Specialist and Military Specialist, FAA, Boston Center. Somehow it was determined that American 11 was still in the air, so I was the one who made the call to Northeast Air Defense Command and advised them that American 11 was still in the air. Of course, I was incorrect.
Lieutenant Colonel Kevin Nisipany. We also had the indication, misinformation that we received through FAA channels, that Flight 11 never crashed and was heading toward Washington. Major General Larry Arnold. I wanted to scramble our Langley aircraft right then. F-16s out of North Dakota were on alert at Langley Air Force Base in Virginia.
Ben Sliney, National Operations Manager, FAA Command Center, Herndon, Virginia. While we were trying to get information, New York Center starts to have a problem also. They were having a problem with an aircraft. It was United 175, it turns out.
Major General Larry Arnold. I said, "Bob, we need to get those Langley fighters over Washington, D.C. in case we are under attack. Other airplanes now are being called, possibly hijacked by the FAA.
Colonel Bob Marr, we are looking at a host of potential problems.
Captain Craig Borgstrom, F-16 pilot and Squadron Operations Commander, Langley Air Force Base. The guy from the sector asked me, how many can you get airborne right now? I told him I had two on battle stations. He said, that's not what I asked. How many total airplanes can you send up? I said, I'll give you three. He said, then go.
In the air throughout the Northeast, confused airline pilots tried to decipher the chaos engulfing the country and air traffic controllers below.
Chuck Saval, pilot Midwest Express Flight 73. I was the captain of the Midwest Express flight from Milwaukee to Newark. We descended toward Newark on a normal and beautiful morning. We heard another airline pilot on the radio say, "We heard something about a plane hitting the World Trade Center." We were 25 miles away in the air. I looked out the window. We saw the flames and smoke.
Gerald Earwood, pilot, Midwest Express, Flight 7. I was flying Milwaukee to New York LaGuardia. We started down to 18,000 feet and saw the smoke coming off the first tower that had been hit. We thought it was an air conditioning unit that was on fire.
As the two Midwest flights approached New York, just two among dozens of planes then inbound to the region's three busy airports, each of which in 2001 served about 1,000 flights a day, they found themselves in the midst of the still unfolding attacks as United Flight 175 turned off its transponder and made a left turn toward Manhattan.
Gerald Earwood. I was ordered to take evasive action to avoid colliding with United 175. I witnessed the disaster straight on. We were descending to 4,000 feet on arrival for LaGuardia. The smoke from the first World Trade Center tower was obscuring LaGuardia Airport. I asked the controller, "We cannot see the airport." Three times I called them. There was no chatter, no talk, no anything. Then he came back screaming at us. "Mid-X-7, are you with me?" I said, "Roger, we are descending down to 4,000 feet. He ordered a hard left turn and started screaming, "Turn left immediately, now, now, immediately." I have never had a controller scream like that, be that excited.
Colonel Bob Marr, as we're watching the television, we see another aircraft come into view and hit the second tower of the World Trade Center.
Frank Loprano, Chief of Aeronautical Operations, Newark Airport, Port Authority. I had picked up binoculars and was looking at the Trade Center. I just put the binoculars down on the desk, and the second building erupted in flames. I picked up the direct line to the control tower and said, "Newark is closed. We're launching bombs."
Ben Sliney, we were discussing shutting down all the traffic on the East Coast to deal with New York's problem. We were shutting all that traffic down when right before our eyes, United 175 came onto the television screen.
Gerald Earwood. As we were coming out of the right turn, we heard an aircraft announce on the frequency, "We saw an airplane hit the World Trade Center." I looked up and saw the impact of United 175.
Lieutenant Colonel Kevin DeSipany. It was an oh shit mode. That's the best way to describe it. Disbelief. We're under attack. We figured if there's two, there might be more.
Lieutenant Colonel Tim Duffy, F-15 pilot, Otis Air Force Base, Cape Cod, Massachusetts. They say the second aircraft hit the World Trade Center, so confusion in my cockpit. The second aircraft?
Ben Sliney, when United 175 struck the building, I told them to ground stop every plane in the country regardless. No one could take off.
Within minutes, New York had closed its airports and begun redirecting inbound aircraft to other locations.
Lieutenant Colonel Tim Duffy, we were about 60 to 70 miles outside Manhattan, and I could see the towers burning. Right then, I looked up and said, "Okay, obviously everything just changed." From my personal mindset, we took off to go help somebody, then looked up to see it burning and said, "Okay, now people are dying." You switch into combat mindset.
Susan Baer, General Manager, Newark International Airport. I called the manager of JFK and said, "Have you heard anything?" As I'm speaking to him, the second plane hit the South Tower, which we saw. The impact, the smoke. I said, "The Trade Center's been hit again. I'm closing the airport. You should do the same."
Chuck Saval, pilot, Midwest Express Flight 73. At that point, we had to go figure out our plan B. How much fuel did we have and where could we go? Our initial thought was going to look at LaGuardia. Our dispatchers were watching this on CNN. They told us to get as far from the East Coast as we possibly could, so that is what we did. We headed for Cleveland.
Lieutenant Colonel Tim Duffy. They came back on and said NORAD took control of all the airspace in the country. Proceed directly to Manhattan and set up combat air patrol. I said, okay, got that. It was a very surreal experience, flying over Central Park at 1,000 feet and 500 knots, trying to identify possible targets. That was just wrong. You should never be doing this over Manhattan.
At 9:24 a.m., the fighters at Langley Air Force Base were scrambled. Initially, not realizing the threat they were facing, the fighters were sent east toward the Atlantic Ocean, following standard policies intended to intercept incoming Russian bombers.
Captain Craig Borgstrom. Shortly after takeoff, they changed our heading more northwesterly toward D.C. and gave us max subsonic. That's as fast as you can go without breaking the sound barrier. I've never heard it before in my short career, but I don't think anyone's heard that order before.
Central, we're under attack. The second plane. At 8:59 a.m., Sean Rooney, the Vice President of Risk Management Services for the Aon Corporation, located on the 98th floor of the South Tower, called his wife Beverly and left a voicemail message. At first, he didn't register much personal concern, pointing out that the explosion had occurred in the other building. 2 minutes later, at 9:01, he called back and left another voicemail. In the background, the recording captured the announcement over the PA system by the Port Authority, reassuring occupants of the South Tower that they were okay. 2 minutes after the Port Authority announcement, television viewers across the country who had tuned in to see the dramatic live footage of the crash at the North Tower watched as United Airlines Flight 175 appeared on their screens. The attacks interrupted the final minutes of morning news shows, broadcasting the horror in New York City into the homes of millions of people sitting down to breakfast, racing to get kids to school, or readying themselves for a September Tuesday at work.
Jane Clayson, anchor, The Early Show, CBS. It was a fairly light news day. We were finishing a segment with a woman who runs Gourmet magazine. We were about to close the show.
Katie Couric, anchor, The Today Show, NBC. I was in the back room where you could go between segments to work on what's next, take a break, or drink a cup of coffee. Matt Lauer was doing an interview with somebody who had written a book about Howard Hughes. I looked up at the monitor, and I saw the World Trade Center was on fire. I thought, oh, wow. I looked at the time and was like, thank God it's before 9 o'clock when most people get to work. Right away, Matt cut that interview short, and I scurried back in next to him and started to try to decipher what had happened.
Dana Burnett, at home in San Ramon, California, wife of United Flight 93 passenger Tom Burnett. I was awakened by the three children running into my room, normal for most mornings. They came in a little before 6 a.m., and I immediately got up and out of bed. Anna Claire and our 2 5-year-old twins, Hallie and Madison, told me what they wanted for breakfast. I turned on the television. I noticed that on every station there was a news report about the World Trade Center. I thought, my goodness, air traffic control must be terribly messed up.
Jane Clayson. The first witnesses kept saying it was a commercial jet. My co-anchor, Bryant Gumbel, and I kept asking, are you sure? I was thinking to myself, this must have been an accident. You're certain it wasn't a small plane? Witness after witness said, I am positive it was a commercial jet.
Katie Couric. The first glimpse of it, I don't think I appreciated how massive the fire was because it looked like it was coming out of the side of the building. Smoke was obscuring a lot of the gaping hole that was there. I remember my hand was shaking like a leaf. Al Roker was very helpful because he knew a lot about the structure of the building because he had been in local news there when that first bomb went off in the basement in 93.
Dina Burnett. The phone rang, and it was my mom who said, "Dina, have you seen the television? They're saying this is an American Airlines flight that's gone into the towers. Tom's in New York, isn't he?" I said, "Don't worry, Mom. He'd be flying United or Delta." I reassured her. "Mom, don't worry. Planes crash all the time, and Tom's never on them."
Katie Couric. We were talking, we were getting eyewitness accounts, and then, of course, the really chilling and shocking visual was when that second plane was flying toward the building. It felt like it was in suspended animation.
Jane Clayson. We saw it live. As it rounded the corner, there were people in the studio pointing to monitors. You could see it coming. You could hear gasps throughout the studio. Then it exploded into that building. There was silence. We all looked at one another.
Katie Couric. Matt said, "This is obviously something deliberate." I remember thinking, well, don't say that yet. If you remember the Oklahoma City bombing, everybody assumed that was the work of Muslim extremists. I was very cautious about calling it that. I was sort of paralyzed, but I wanted to be careful about characterizing it a certain way. But Matt said right away, "This is a terrorist attack."
Peter Jennings, anchor, ABC News. "I simply put my hands in the air and told everybody in the newsroom to stay quiet because we didn't know what was happening. Our suspicions were instant. Rather than risk saying something foolish, I let the audience absorb it."
At 9:03 a.m., traveling at about 590 miles per hour, United Flight 175 crashed into the South Tower, 2 World Trade Center, hitting at an angle, its lower left wing slicing into the 77th and 78th floors, which housed the sky lobby used to transfer from express to local elevators, and its upper right wing hitting the 85th floor. Most of the impact zone, floors 78 to 83, was occupied by Fuji Bank, where employees had evacuated after the attack on the North Tower, only to return to their offices when told by the Port Authority that the incident was under control. Fuji Bank ultimately lost 23 employees and visitors in the attack. Only a single stairway in the South Tower, Stairwell A, survived the crash. Fewer than 20 people would escape from the impact zone or above.
Stanley Paramnath, Fuji Bank, South Tower, 81st floor. "I was watching toward the direction of the Statue of Liberty and something caught my eye. A plane. And this plane is getting closer."
Stephen Biankowski, Aviation Unit, NYPD. "Our helicopter was on the southwest side of the South Tower. I glanced over my shoulder and there came a United Airlines aircraft right at us, a little bit underneath where we were. I do mean underneath us. It probably missed us by about 300 feet.
James Cowan, Harbor Unit, NYPD. "The second plane came in so tight, the NYPD helicopter pilot took evasive action and pulled up."
Stephen Biankowski. "It proceeded to fly right through the building, right in front of us. I must have gone numb. I don't remember hearing an explosion, although it must have been extremely loud. It was all I could handle to watch that happen."
Melinda Murphy. "We had gone back to our newsroom for the postmortem of our show. We had video monitors up. The television was always on. I saw the buildings on fire. My photographer ran to the assignment desk and said, 'You've got to launch the helicopter.' I got in a cab and called my husband. I said, 'Listen, I'm going to be really late tonight.' Just as we pulled up to the 30th Street heliport, the second plane hit. It was this unbelievable scene. The fire was right outside our window. In my ear, they were like, 'We have to go live. Are we ready to go live?' I wasn't even ready to say, 'Oh my God,' out loud, much less talk about it on camera. But I did.
Robert Small, office manager, Morgan Stanley, South Tower, 72nd floor. I called my wife. There was this sudden swoosh, bang, boom. It was the most violent ride I have ever been on. The plane came in over us. We were on floor 72, and it hit floor 78. I was thrown onto my desk and then thrown back about two or three times. Stuff came off of the walls. Shelves came down. I pick up the phone and my wife's screaming, "What happened?" I said, "Something exploded." She said, "Get out of there." I said, "Okay, I'll call you later." There was no, "I love you if I don't see you again."
Michael McAvoy, Associate Director, Bear Stearns. I was in my office in downtown Brooklyn with a clear view of the World Trade Center. The smoke was thick and black. I walked back to my desk to call my buddy Jimmy, my best friend for over 30 years. He worked for Cantor Fitzgerald in Tower 1 on the 104th floor. No answer. Maybe, just maybe, took the day off and went golfing. Man, I hope so. After the second plane hit, I ran back to my desk and called my mom. She told me that my brother John, a New York City fireman with Ladder 3 on 13th Street, had worked the night tour, so he was still in the firehouse when the planes hit. I called his firehouse. No answer.
Charles Kristoff, attorney, Broadway. I called my office, and the receptionist told me that my wife, Kristen L. Kristoff, called and said that the first tower was hit. I don't know if she saw or she knew, because her office was on the 104th floor in the South Tower. She told my receptionist that she was safe and there was nothing to worry about, and she would call me later. I went back to my office at 225 Broadway. I was waiting for her call and trying to make calls. She was not answering. And we heard the second explosion.
Louise Bazzelli. A lot of phone calls started coming in. At first, nobody wanted to ask me the question. One particular phone call I remember was from his cousin, Ralph. He's like Pasquale's brother. He goes, "Don't worry, Pasquale's going to get out. It's okay." He said, "Did you hear from him?" I said, "Yeah, we spoke." He said that they were going to be leaving. As I was on the phone with him, we both saw the second plane hit at the same time. He was seeing it live from his building, and I saw it right on the television. Judith Wine. I walked my way down from 103 to 78, met up with my colleagues, and we were standing around in the sky lobby waiting our turn to get in the big cattle car elevators to go down. When the second plane hit, I basically went flying to the total opposite end. I thought, so this is how it ends? Is this what life is? Going to work, getting there like 7 in the morning, leaving at 5, taking an hour and a half each way to commute, and not having much of a life? Is this what it's all about? I landed on my arm, which got smashed. I had 3 cracked ribs, a slightly punctured lung. I had abdominal bleeding, but I was okay. The arm broke my fall. Later, the doctor asked, "What landed on you?" I said, "Me."
Stanley Paramnath. I'm scared I'm going to get sucked out by the air pressure. I'm holding on to all this mangled furniture.
Jean Potter. We made our way into the sky lobby. That's when the South Tower was hit. There was this other huge explosion you could see out the window. I saw fireballs and paper, and it's like, oh God, what is this? What now? We got back onto our original staircase and started descending.
Joe Esposito, Chief of Department, NYPD. All the debris is coming down. We looked up, and it reminded me of the old cartoon with the Roadrunner when the coyote is watching everything come down on him. The safe, or whatever the Roadrunner would throw at him, would come down. It was getting bigger and bigger. The debris is getting bigger and bigger as it's getting close to us.
Lieutenant Mickey Cross, Engine 16, FDNY. It reminded me of those movies, those old Godzilla movies, where the monster would come out of the ocean and everybody would be running and screaming and tripping and falling down.
David Norman. One of the landing wheels from the aircraft fell, burning right in front of us. It was almost like the size of a Volkswagen landing in the street. Bernie Carrick, Commissioner, NYPD. Debris and body parts and the plane and the building, it was all coming down right on top of us. I'm yelling at my staff to get aviation to close down the airspace. I'm screaming at these guys to get me air support. They're looking at me like, is there a fucking number to call for an F-16?
Frank Rosano. The next thing I heard was a huge explosion. And this time I got up. I opened the drapes, I looked out the window, and I saw fireballs falling into the street. Cars were on fire. I turned on the television. I saw on TV that they were reporting that two planes had hit the World Trade Center. My thought was, this is very unfortunate, but this is going on basically 60 to 70 stories above me. It's got nothing to do with me. I've got a case that's going to trial in approximately 1 week. I've got a lot of work to do. My thought at that moment was, the fire department would come down. They'd put out the fire, and while this is a tragic incident, that'd be that. I turned on my heels, and I went into the bathroom. I took a shower, I shaved, and I got dressed.
Fernando Ferrer. We hear the report. A second plane hit Tower 2. I said, let's go back to the Bronx. This is no accident. Kalman Yeager, my assistant, said, no, we got a campaign schedule. I repeated, this is not an accident. He said, no, we got to head downtown. We got to... I said, there is no more campaign.
Dan Potter, firefighter, Ladder 10 FDNY, at the study session for the lieutenant's exam in Staten Island. I start going through the questions. Somebody came busting through the doors and says, holy shit, two planes hit the Trade Center. Harvey Hurrell's phone rang next to me real quick, and I heard him say, two planes, another plane hit the Trade Center. Harvey Hurrell died in the Trade Center. He was from Rescue 5 in Staten Island. He called from the American Legion Hall back to the firehouse, don't let that truck leave till I get there. It was close. He was off duty, and he told them, I want to get on the truck with you.
Bill Spade, firefighter, Rescue 5, FDNY. I heard them say on the radio, basically, we have a huge fire. Send me 4 more rescues. To have 4 rescues responding at the same time for the same fire was unprecedented. As I made my way up West Street, it's only a short distance between there and the Trade Center, body parts were everywhere. I remember trying to go around them, and I couldn't. I said a little prayer. I said, I'm going to run over them. And I did.
Joe Esposito. I go on the radio. I immediately say, Central, we're under attack. A second plane has just hit the second tower. We are under attack.
At home in Riverdale, New Jersey, Louise Buzzelli, 7.5 months pregnant, waited for word on her husband, Pasquale, in the North Tower.
Louise Buzzelli. I never left the television. I remember from the day before he had his work shirt hung over the bedpost, I would always say to him, can you please pick up your things? That day, I just wanted to feel him, and I took the shirt and put it on. We have a cross in our room, and I grabbed the cross, and I was praying to God that this would be over, and he could get out, and this would all be something that we could get past, and the world could get past.
Pasquale Buzzelli, engineer, Port Authority, North Tower, 64th floor. We actually watched a replay of the second plane hitting. It was a snowy picture on one of the televisions in the conference room. That's when we knew that this was no accident.
Louise Buzzelli. He did call me one more time after the second plane crashed into the second building. I thought he was now downstairs, so I was like, oh, thank God. I was like, oh, did you make it down? Are you okay? Where are you? He's like, no, we're still here. I got so angry at him.
Pasquale Buzzelli. She said, what are you still doing there? Get out. I said, I know, Louise. I said, we're fine here. We're going to be leaving soon. She kept saying, get the hell out.
The second attack transformed and complicated the already massive rescue effort at the World Trade Center. At 9:10 a.m., the NYPD declared an unprecedented second level 4 mobilization, summoning another 1,000 officers and supervisors to the scene. The FDNY similarly called a second 5th alarm, dispatching hundreds more firefighters, including 23 engines and 13 ladder companies. That number doesn't include numerous fire companies, firefighters, EMTs, and paramedics who continued to self-dispatch. And because the attacks took place around the time of the standard 9 a.m. shift change, many trucks were riding heavy, that is, carrying firefighters from both the night and day tours. PAPD officers flooded into the area around the World Trade Center, even as other colleagues moved to close the bridges and tunnels into New York City, part of a precautionary security procedure known as Operation Omega. PAPD's superintendent, Fred V. Marone, began climbing up the North Tower Stairwell B at 9:11 a.m. to assess the damage above. City officials struggled to organize a response to the attacks, in part because New York's $13 million Emergency Command Center was housed on the 23rd floor of 7 World Trade Center, and it was evacuated soon after the attacks. There was no backup location. The city's leaders, including Mayor Rudy Giuliani, who quickly made his way to the area, instead improvised a response plan as they worked out of makeshift command posts.
Dan Nigro, Chief of Operations, FDNY. The horror of the day had just multiplied exponentially.
Captain Jay Jonas, Ladder 6, FDNY, awaiting orders in the North Tower's ground floor lobby command post. I'm standing there. It was very loud, as you can imagine. The acoustics in the lobby of the World Trade Center weren't really good. A lot of echoes. And all of a sudden, it got very quiet. One of the firemen from Rescue 1 looked up and said, "We may not live through today." We looked at him, and we looked at each other, and we said, "You're right." We took the time to shake each other's hands and wish each other good luck and hope I'll see you later, which is especially poignant for me because we all had that acknowledgement that this might be our last day on Earth, and we went to work anyway.
Juana Lomi. Now things started getting worse. I said, "Listen, guys, anybody you cannot quick triage, not breathing properly, chest pain, leg fractures, anything on the leg that they can't run, they're going to go on the ambulance. Nobody else is going on the ambulance. They're going to run. They're going to use their legs or whatever."
Monsignor John Delendick, Chaplain, FDNY. The look on Chief of Department Peter Gansey's face was really amazing because Gansey usually had two looks when he was out of fire. The first would be a look of defiance, saying, "We got you, we got you." The second one was more of a jovial thing. Once things were settling down and the fire was dark and down, he would joke a lot. He'd walk around, talk to people. This was a real look of fear. I never saw this on him before.
Bernie Kerik. Mayor Giuliani made a comment to me like, "We're in uncharted territory. The city has never experienced anything like this."
Detective David Brink. I was trying to cinch up my belt from my rope rescue gear. I felt a pat on my shoulder. I looked up, and it was Rudolph Giuliani. He said, "Be careful going in there." I said, "Thanks."
Thomas Von Essen, Commissioner, FDNY. I remember seeing Ray Downey, the head of special operations, in the lobby, and he said, "These buildings can collapse." He said it in passing, not that these buildings will collapse in 40 minutes and we have to get everybody out, or not that they'll collapse by tomorrow, or not that they necessarily will collapse at all. Just that they can collapse. That was the first sense I had of the enormity of this.
Captain Jay Jonas. I was thinking that Chief Pete Hayden was going to send me over to the other building because nobody was there yet. I said, "Another plane has hit the second tower." He closed his eyes, nodded his head, and said he knew. He said, "Take your guys upstairs here and do the best you can for search and rescue."
Across the region, even as the massive NYPD and FDNY mobilizations activated additional units, off-duty first responders and those who lived outside of Manhattan realized the magnitude of the disaster and began to make their way downtown. At 9:29 a.m., FDNY issued a full recall, bringing all of its employees back to work. Ultimately, 60 of the FDNY personnel killed on 9/11 were supposed to be off-duty that morning.
Dan Potter, firefighter, ladder 10, FDNY in Staten Island. I ran to the front of the American Legion building. I could look right across